Oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-5291, Cassandra M. Payne, Appellant versus Kenneth Lee Salazar, Secretary, Department of Interior. Mr. Branch for Appellant, Mr. Natiello for Appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor. The District Court's dismissal of Ms. Payne's retaliation claim denied her the right to file this claim in court. If Ms. Payne's only claim was the retaliation claim and she lost that claim at the administrative level, she would have the absolute right to file that claim in court. If she has a right to file that claim in court, she should not lose that right simply because the agency consolidated that claim, the unsuccessful claim, with another claim, and she prevailed at the administrative level on the unrelated discrimination claim. The claims were consolidated at the administrative level for the convenience of the agency, not for Ms. Payne. She did not have the right to say, I want these claims heard separately. The claims were heard together. She prevailed on the...
So I understand. She filed a separate claim on retaliation. She didn't try to amend the original complaint or anything.
That's correct, Your Honor. So there was a... She filed a claim of failure to accommodate her religious beliefs, and then she filed a claim of retaliation related to actions that she believed took place after she filed her initial EEO complaint. We believe the district court's decision was an error. It's clear that claims that involve a challenge to a remedy, those types of claims can't be split. But this claim does not involve a challenge to a remedy. This involves a challenge to a separate issue altogether. And just to give the court an example, if there are two federal employees and they both file retaliation claims and one person loses on both claims, that person has a right to file a complaint in court. Here, Ms. Payne was in a position of filing a retaliation and a discrimination claim. She prevailed on one claim and she lost on the second claim, but she's barred from filing a complaint in court to challenge the claim that she was unsuccessful on. Why would it make sense to force someone to relitigate a claim that she does not want to relitigate just so she could be heard on the claim that she was unsuccessful on? That would not make sense, at least in our opinion.
Mr. Branch, you had a second retaliation claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's a separate issue, unrelated issue, as to it's a distinct issue as to whether... There's no question you didn't exhaust on that, right?
That's correct. She did not exhaust. She attempted to return.
So you want to hook that to the same train?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, she has a retaliation claim, and this claim that she attempted to add on was another retaliation claim. Her position was that when she attempted to return to work.
The standard is that it's a like or related claim. Is that it?
That's correct, Your Honor, arising out of the same set of facts.
Yeah, that's key. Okay, so... And in some case, we or the Supreme Court has said that would have arisen during the investigation, right? Because it arises out of the same fact. And here the investigation is closed. In fact, she's been paid.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how could this have arisen out of the investigation?
Well, Your Honor.
In lieu of exhaustion.
Well, in the sense of arising out of the investigation, it would not arise out of that investigation because she had already been paid, but it arises out of the same core issues here. Her complaint is discrimination and retaliation. She was awarded her damages, and then she attempted to return to work, and she was essentially told that.
But the standard that where that case comes from, and I'm not sure if this is equally true of all the cases in which it's been applied, but the idea was, in the original case, that the person was discriminated against as when applying to be the acting head of something, and then filed a complaint. And then there was another round of decisions to choose a permanent head, and she was denied that. And so it was inevitable. I mean, it was sort of foretold that while they were going to be investigating whether the first one was discriminatory, that she would be denied the second one as well. It was almost inevitable. So she didn't have to file a separate complaint for that. In this current instance, the first one is over, right? The complaint's been settled, been paid. 4 years have elapsed, I think.
2004 to 2008, that's correct, Your Honor.
And she alleges retaliation again, and you say she doesn't have to exhaust?
Well, Your Honor,
I go right to court?
I think if she has a retaliation claim that's already in court, and this happens, our position is that she should be permitted to go directly to court.
Why? What if it's through the court already, or there wasn't any in the, she already won her court case, let's say.
If there was no court, if there was no case in court?
None pending. She'd already won her court case.
Well, if there was no case in court, she would have to go through and exhaust the claim, but she should.
Why not just file a complaint in court?
Well.
Say it relates back.
Our position is that it needs to be linked to something, to litigation that's already pending or in court. And I think the court's decision.
But the issue is whether she has to exhaust, right? And you're saying she doesn't have to exhaust if there's something she can hook it onto, but she does have to exhaust if it would be a matter of just filing a complaint.
That's correct.
Even though the substance might be the same.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that that's the position that we would take. And I think the court's decision in Sachs-Singh, I always get this case name mispronounced.
Sachs-Singh.
I think that case, you know, confirms our position, at least on the facts.
Well, there was
a year.
There was a year there. Let me just see what else I've got about that. All right, there was a year separating the retaliation from the previous discrimination alleged. The obligation to reconsider her at the final decision point, because they discriminated against her at the early stage, right, was something that was put into the settlement agreement. I mean, there's no question it grew out of the same facts, right? There was a discrimination complaint, a settlement saying we will reconsider you fairly for the final decision, and then a claim that they didn't.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. In terms of the actual settlement agreement
It was a temporary appointment, right, and then a permanent appointment. Okay.
Yes. Now, in Ms. Payne's case, her matter proceeded before the EEOC. There was an award in her favor, and the agency was given specific directions on what they would do, what they had to do to correct that order, and that would include no retaliation as well. The administrative judge's decision is not in the record here.
Well, is the June 08 amendment, which raises the more recent retaliation,
yes,
is it couched in terms of a violation of a prior settlement?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I believe it's just couched in terms of the prior EEO activity. And I would like to reserve the remainder of the time.
Surely. Morning, Your Honors. Christian Atiello on behalf of Kenneth Salazar. May it please the court. The heart of this case is the government's contention that Title VII plaintiffs are not allowed to bring the claims they lost at the administrative level while shielding the claims they won from de novo review. In other words, Title VII administrative claims cannot be split at the district court level.
What words of the statute do you rely on for that proposition?
The words in 42 U.S.C. 2000E16C that says, after a final action is taken, an employee, if aggrieved by the final disposition of his complaint.
Well, isn't somebody who doesn't win all of his complaint aggrieved?
True, but.
So far you've lost. What's the rest?
Well, they have to be aggrieved with their entire complaint.
Where, No.
It doesn't say aggrieved with the claims within their complaint, just with their complaint.
It doesn't say entire. It says if aggrieved by the final disposition of his complaint. If we decide for you on one of your two arguments today and not on the other, would you be aggrieved? You argue, A, that you can't bring a splitting of claims, and you argue, B, that the second retaliation should be exhausted. If we decide today that you win on this first argument, but you lose on the second, are you aggrieved by our decision that exhaustion is required?
To the extent I wouldn't be able to bring the case back that I lost on, yes, I would be aggrieved.
In fact,
but
you could appeal to the Supreme Court on that ground and not the other, right?
Potentially, yes.
So you would be aggrieved. Otherwise, of course, you couldn't appeal if you weren't aggrieved.
Well, let's put it this way. Ms. Payne had the opportunity. I don't think it's fair to say she's denied the right to file her retaliation claim.
I didn't say anything like that. I'm asking you for the words. We're all textualists now.
Sure.
So tell us which words in the statute get you where you want to go.
I think the word complaint. I don't think it says claims in the complaint. It says the complaint. She has to be aggrieved by her entire complaint, which means she needs to bring that entire complaint to the district court level.
She's putting entire in there, but it just doesn't parse.
If she filed, imagine for the moment that she did not, this wasn't a Title VII case at all, okay? And she brings two claims, that she was assaulted and that there was defamation during the assault, okay? And she wins defamation and loses the assault claim. Can she appeal to this court?
Yes.
Even though on her complaint she can appeal without bringing one, just on the one that she lost, right?
Yes.
And the only reason she can appeal is because she's aggrieved, otherwise she wouldn't have standing, right?
True.
So far, those words don't go the way you want them to go.
Well, I think the issue, again, I think it goes back to the fact that she can bring her retaliation claim. It's not that she's prevented from bringing it. She just needs to bring them both.
Well, now you're making a policy argument or some kind of it's not so bad argument. I'm looking for textual argument.
And how is she aggrieved by, she's got to bring the discrimination forward. How is she aggrieved by that discrimination claim that she won?
I guess she wouldn't be aggrieved by the discrimination claim, but she is aggrieved by her complaint, by her administrative complaint.
So what does the court do? Say, well, we've got both of these claims, and you've asked us to give de novo review to them, but you're not aggrieved by the discrimination.
She's aggrieved by her complaint. And you know, I think it's important to realize.
Well, let me ask you this: if we carried that sentence forward so that it said, "An employee or applicant for employment, if aggrieved by the final disposition of his complaint, or by the failure to take final action on his complaint, may file a civil action seeking de novo review of any portion of the final disposition of his complaint by which he is aggrieved." I mean, that to me is how you finish off that sentence.
Of 2000E16C? I think that's reading into it.
Presumably, the people who wrote this were familiar with civil litigation.
Right? Presumably.
Yeah. And if they're departing from it, from the model of civil litigation in such a substantial way, I would expect them to have made that clear. But what they've written here is totally consistent with ordinary civil litigation. You're aggrieved by the disposition of the complaint. You appeal the portion by which you're aggrieved.
At the same time, I think they could have easily said, or the claims therein, and they didn't.
And they wouldn't have said that in civil litigation.
They may not have.
I mean, if you're aggrieved by a final order of an agency, you don't have to seek review of the entire order.
True. Right?
If you're aggrieved by by an order of the district court, you don't have to seek review of the entire order.
I mean, there's no language in 2000E16 which says that it's an appeal okay, that what they're doing is appealing the administrative record.
She's not appealing. She's filing a new civil action.
Right. Which has to be related to her complaint at the administrative level, and now it's not. Now she's parsing. Now she's picking and choosing. Let's take another hypothetical. Let's say she'd won $300,000 on her discrimination claim. Could she then turn around and try to get another $300,000 on her retaliation claim? I don't think so. I think that because there's a compensatory cap on complaints, on per complainant, it's what is what 1981A, I believe, it's section 42 U.S.C. 1981A and then B3, I believe it is. And that's been added, that's been
added in the last decade, was it not?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't the cap added within the last decade?
I don't know, but in a case.
I think your colleague will know.
It's
It was.
It was an amendment that was applied, I think, across the board to a type of claims. It's, in other words, it's not. It's in 1981.
1981A.
It's not specific to this statute. The statute pre-exists that cap. And the cap may be applicable to the whole complaint. I don't know. That issue isn't in front of us.
Has any court said it's applicable to the whole complaint?
This court said it's per complainant. We read it in a case, Fogg v.
Was the issue there as against claims that hadn't been appealed?
It was Fogg v. Ashcroft, 254 F3rd 103. It's 2001 case.
F3rd 103?
Yes.
This isn't cited in your brief at all, right?
It's not.
Is the cap mentioned?
Is the cap mentioned in the brief? No, it is not, Your Honor. Just trying to give some context for the way Title VII works.
Mm-hmm. You want to say anything about the exhaustion issue?
Yes, I think that your questions were on point. I think sex-sentencing is misplaced for two reasons. First, the decision whether to entertain the unexhausted retaliation claim lies with the court's discretion, which means it's not mandatory. It's not, the court didn't have to take that case or to take that claim regardless of the fact that it wasn't exhausted. The second is it completely ignores Morgan, which came after sex-sentencing.
What about Weber and Wiley, both of which come after Morgan and are in this court? What about the decisions in those cases?
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with them. If you could...
Really?
So yes.
These are two cases decided in 2007 in which the court says that the question is whether it could have reasonably been expected to grow out of appellant's prior complaint. Do you agree that that is the standard?
If it is, I don't think that this reasonably came out of appellant's.
I got that. That's the fallback argument. Let's start with the first argument. You agree?
Cases
don't. One of them says that one of the circuits applies Morgan, as you argue, and we didn't need to decide that. And the next case decides based on whether or not it could have reasonably been expected to grow out of appellant's prior complaint.
If that's the standard, then again, I would go back to my fallback argument, which is
couldn't reasonably arise out of it.
Right.
So the EEOC actually has regulations which permit it to consider a claim that could have reasonably arose out of the claims first raised, right?
I think so, yes.
So if the agency is allowed to do that, and we're using the agency's regulations as determining exhaustion, does that seem like a reasonable place to make the test?
It certainly could be, yes.
And in this case, your argument would be that it couldn't have risen out of it because the investigation was over.
Completely, yes.
So we wouldn't have to make the Morgan argument at all. We wouldn't have to resolve whether Morgan changes the law or not.
Correct. I mean, and the truth is the complaint, you really can't get a sense of what happened here, who was retaliating against her, when exactly it happened, how it happened.
No, the date is January 2008, which is after the final decision by the agency. So on any theory, you win that an argument that it couldn't have arisen out of the investigation because the investigation is clearly over.
I certainly would argue that, yes.
Totally within the agency's discretion whether to join two claims, is that right?
I don't think it's discretionary, actually. I think that the regulations seem to suggest that it's mandatory. The regulation.
I'm sorry. Okay. So that even if they're totally unrelated, the agency must join them.
Yes, that seems to be what this is. Regulation 1614.606.
So if that weren't the regulation, and these were filed separately, she would be able to bring the case? In other words, if she filed a religious discrimination claim and then separately filed a retaliation claim, and an unrelated one, as you're suggesting this one is, and the agency did not join them, then, and she lost discrimination but not retaliation, she won discrimination but not retaliation, she would be able to bring the retaliation claim, right?
Presumably, but there's some timing issues involved. If you look at 2000 E16,
assuming she exhausted properly, she did it.
Well, in other words, I think if they were in close in time, they probably would have been mandatorily consolidated.
Mandatorily
if they
consolidated by the agency or by the statute?
By the agency because of the regulation,
not because of the statute.
Right, not because of the statute.
So your position really is that the agency has passed a regulation which is not required by the statute, but that now determines whether she's allowed to bring a claim or not.
True, but again, the timing of it is important. Okay, if she files within any time within 180 days, once 180 days elapse, she can bring suit on that first claim. So let's say that second claim comes within those 180 days, presumably they're going to be consolidated.
Nothing in the statute requires them to be consolidated.
No, again, it's just a regulation.
So this permits, if you're right, that means the agency can determine her statutory rights based on a regulation which is not itself required by the statute.
And what statutory right are you talking about?
Well, she has a statutory right if she's aggrieved, right? By the loss of a complaint to file in civil court, correct?
Correct.
All right. So if she files the retaliation claim separately, right, and the agency does not consolidate it, right?
Yes.
Then she has a statutory right to appeal, to file an action for the retaliation claim, right?
Presumably, yes.
Not presumably.
Yes, she would.
She would be aggrieved, right?
Right.
The only thing, in your view, that stops her from being aggrieved is the agency's decision to consolidate.
Again, it's not a decision. It's the way the regulations were written.
To establish a regulation that requires consolidation.
Yes.
And the statute does not tell the agency to do that, to file that.
It doesn't, but for policy reasons, that's the way the regulation was written.
That regulation's issued by EEOC?
I'm sorry?
Is that an EEOC regulation? I think it is.
I believe it is, yes.
So it wasn't your agency that promulgated it.
That's true, yes.
By EEOC and supposed to be adhered to by all the agencies.
That's correct.
Sort of unusual for an agency's own regulations to affect what statutory rights a plaintiff has.
Again, I don't think her statutory rights are being abrogated here. She can bring both claims. She's not prevented from bringing the retaliation claim. Okay. It's just we want de novo review of the whole case. That's what I think the statute says. Let's take a look at everything here. Okay? They're always, or you know, in this case in particular, I think they're related.
Do you agree that if the two claims were not consolidated, there would be no de novo review of the one she won?
True, but I guess it's hard to imagine a case where they wouldn't be consolidated.
Well, if the agency didn't have this regulation, they wouldn't be consolidated.
That's true, but the regulation exists, and the agencies do have this regulation that they have to work with.
Maybe it's an unlawful regulation. What gives the agency the authority to issue this regulation?
Well, again, it was issued by EEOC.
Right. What gives EEOC the authority to issue this regulation?
That I don't know. I don't know where the EEOC gets its authority to make regulations. But you know, I don't think the constitutionality of this statute or this regulation is really being challenged here. I think it's really just how it's operating. And I
don't see a constitutional issue.
That's no, the authority to issue it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Branch.
Mr. Branch, could I just ask you about this second retaliation and exhaustion claim? You do say in your brief that at a minimum,
Title VII claims must arise from the administrative investigation that can reasonably be expected to follow the charge of discrimination, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree that's that if Morgan doesn't destroy your position altogether, this is the best you can get is that rule, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, and the purpose of that rule is that the expectation that the agency would discover this retaliation during the course of its investigation.
I believe.
So therefore, no reason for the party to have to file over and over again to retaliation that occurs during the investigation stage, right?
Yes, I would agree.
So you really, do we not have an insoluble problem with respect to a claim that arises not only after the investigation is over, but after the EEOC is completely finished with it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it is a difficult issue for us, but I do believe that the allegations made in this second retaliation claim are at least closely related enough to the retaliation claims that were already existing that they should be. Is there some support for joining those claims with the existing retaliation claims rather than requiring her to go back and refile another retaliation claim when she already has a claim of retaliation pending in court?
Closely related how? Not in time. So how? What do you mean?
Arising out of the same core set of facts. Her claim is that they discriminated against me based on religion. As a result of that, they retaliated against me in ways A, B, and C.
So if there was a discrimination at time one, and then it's adjudicated in favor of the employee, and then 4 years later, there's another act of discrimination, same kind of thing. Not retaliation, just another act of discrimination by someone who didn't know about the first charge, so it wasn't retaliation. That would also be related, right?
Well, I'm not sure in terms of whether that would be because that's so different from our facts. In this particular case, the claim was resolved in November or December, and in January, she's attempts to go back to work, and they're telling her you can't come back to work.
Your argument is that really that any retaliation for the same thing is related, right? In other words, your argument here is that she was discriminated against, she filed a complaint, and then she was retaliated against once, which is the first thing we're talking about, and then she was retaliated again in 2008 for the same thing, for the filing of the complaint. Is that right?
That's the argument,
that's
essentially.
That's really the only way in which they're related.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Branch. Thank you. Case is submitted.
Mr. Branch, I just want to ask.
I'm sorry.
We're all aware you have suffered a terrible accident. How are you doing?
I'm doing much better, thank you. Just recovering. I appreciate the court's concern. Thank you.
Stand, please. This honorable court will now take a brief recess.
During which 2/3 of the court will remain here.
But not in secret. Anybody can watch who wants to watch this.
Yes, thank you. There will be a brief ceremony swearing in new attorneys to the court momentarily when we reconvene. Yes. Be seated, please.
It pleases the court. Judge Ginsburg, Judge Garland, I present two candidates for admission to the bar of the D.C. Circuit. Matthew Hardwick Blumenstein is a graduate of Stanford and Vanderbilt Law School. James Edward Tice is a double who, having gone to UVA as an undergraduate and law school. So they're here to answer any questions you may have and take the oath.
Well, I actually have a question. When we had a graduate of UNC, we required the singing of the school song. Are we going to be requiring that of these two?
I'd like to hear it.
we'll let you off.
Since they're from different schools, it would not harmonize. Mr. Blumstein, are you related to a faculty member at Vanderbilt?
I'm not. Professor Blumstein is not a relation.
Okay.
Every professor at Vanderbilt repeatedly called me Mr. Blumstein, though, assuming the relation, similarity of name.
Okay, so you're absolved of that. And as for the double who, so is my daughter.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, before I swear you into the court, I just want to advise you that the court has an active pro bono program, and we've encouraged the members of our bar to give a significant amount of time each year during their practice here, specifically, if possible, 50 hours per year, but many, many members of the bar exceed that, some by a lot. And I hope you will pursue that as an opportunity that will benefit you as well as your clients. Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, my name, do solemnly swear.
I, James Matthew Tice, Blumenstein, do solemnly swear.
That I will conduct myself as an attorney and counselor of this court.
That I will conduct myself as an attorney and counselor of this court.
Uprightly and according to law.
Uprightly and according to law.
And that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
Congratulations, and thank you, and welcome to the bar.
Thank you.
Good job.
Stand, please. Right.
Looking at the figures, James, you guys know.